You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are and wherever you happen to be all around this beautiful planet, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. And it's a good night for you to be here. It's a good night for all of us, but if you're a first-time listener, it's especially a good night. You're going to really enjoy our guest this evening, I guarantee. I've been getting email, even from my kids over in Texas, about did I see those lights in the sky? And, you know, I didn't say a lot about it. I didn't say a lot about it because, I said that the lights were, there were lights in the sky, and they showed them on the news, and no, I didn't see them. Because I was doing the show at the time, those lights appeared. But I didn't say much about those lights because I, like my good friend over at Alien Seeker News, Don Ellis, have a streak of let's wait and see-ism. And, I mentioned that the lights were there, and that's about it. Now, the reason that I have that streak of let's wait and see-ism is because I know that there are folks who are really stupid enough to try and hoax things, and they for whatever reason, sometimes just to discredit people who are serious about UFO research, and they try to fool them. Sometimes they do it just because they are stupid. And it's just a dumb thing to do. The story has come out now that a Phoenix resident who does not want his name disclosed has admitted that he tied traffic flares to some balloons filled with helium and set them adrift from his backyard. He's saying he did it. Okay, maybe that's the case. Generally, you can tell even at nighttime if you're looking at flares because of the smoke. Now, he's saying that's what it was and that he did it. His next-door neighbor has been on the news here on TV saying, I saw him do it. Maybe. And maybe not. I saw the video and there was no smoke. However, there was a police helicopter that went up and took a look at those lights and said it looks like flares tied to balloons. So maybe it was. I don't know. Generally, with flares, you can see the trail of smoke. Anyone who has ever used traffic flares knows they put out a lot of smoke. Yeah, well, let's wait and see-ism. I don't know what to say about it all yet, except to say, let's wait and see. There were lights in the sky, that much we know, What were they? We don't know yet. And I'm not sure the story that's being told by this guy is real. It is, I would think, somewhat criminal to set flares adrift above populated areas, especially in the desert. And they say, we're probably not going to investigate this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. You know, there's never been a better time for you to start your own broadcast. I know there are a lot of paranormal investigators. I know there are a lot of people who are paranormal experiencers who want to have their own broadcast. Well, now you can right here at Steel Eye Media Network. It is within your grasp. You can do it, and we're waiting to hear from you. Give us a call today at 1-800-318-1008. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
This is Charles Hall.
Hi, this is nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Hardcastle.
This is Jason Martell, researcher into the ancient astronaut theory.
You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show, the number one talk show choice of many galaxies.
My guest this evening is Dr. Joseph Farrell. And I think if you do much reading and you read topics about ancient civilizations and UFOs and things like that, you have run across the writing of Dr. Farrell. I've got one of his books that we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about the cosmic war, but that's not all he's written, and you need to check everything he has written. He's absolutely a brilliant writer, and it's a joy to have him with us this evening. Dr. Farrell, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Well, thank you for being here.
Sure.
You know, once in a while I get a book that I read several times. It's not unheard of. But then there are books that I read several times and am just captivated each time and learn something new each time I read it. And that's been the case with The Cosmic War. It's not just fluff and puff. It's very well documented and very well annotated and laid out. So let me begin by saying thank you for writing that book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the encouraging words. It's very kind of you.
It's not your most recent book. What is your most recent book?
The most recent one is a book called Secrets of the Unified Field, and then the subtitle is The Philadelphia Experiment, The Nazi Bell, and The Discarded Theory.
Well, I've got to get my hands on that. I've had several people on the show talking about the unified field. recently, Dr. Michio Kaku talked about that. Also, Nassim Haramein talked about that, and it's really, really, really some mysterious stuff. For me, it is.
Yeah, it really is, and it's kind of like all my other books, that there's kind of an underlying theme to them all, and that is the very peculiar interplay between, well, sort of off the books physics and an alternative look at history and an explanation for some things that otherwise don't make sense without it.
Well, and that is what you do with the Cosmic War.
Right.
All of us, I would assume, have read what we call mythology. And
right.
About the wars between the gods and the wars between the giants and so forth. And when I read your book, I read, you know what, this really could be plausible, that it actually happened and then got couched in mythological terms.
Right.
So take us through that idea. Give us a flavor for the book here.
Well, the principal core of the book is a series of texts from Egypt and Sumer and the Hurrians that I examine at great length, and I should say something about the text that I'm using. I do not make my own translations. In other words, I do not expose myself to the same type of criticism that's often been leveled at Zechariah Sitchin by academics. I'm relying on academic texts by academics in the field of Sumerology and Egyptology. So, in other words, the conclusions I'm coming to at least cannot be disputed on the basis of mistranslation or inadequate translations and so on. But basically, I examine those texts from the point of view that if we accept the proposition that this war was an actual literal war fought in our own celestial space, in other words, within the solar system, possibly the wider galaxy, then is there a physics sufficient to do some of the things that those texts say that were done by the gods? And if so, what is that physics? Can we find any modern analogs to it? And that basically is kind of the thrust of the book, and I reproduce those texts very extensively so that, you know, readers can actually see them, read them, and see that I'm not, you know, that I'm not making this stuff up, you know.
Well, and that is what I was referring to when I said it's very well documented. You know, it's not presented as just Joseph Farrell's opinion about what might could be.
Right,
it's presented as, well, here are the texts that talk about it, and, you know, here's what they say happened, and is that something possible with the physics that we know about?
Right.
Now, in your book, you talk about the gods battling over something called the tablets or tables of destiny.
Right.
What is that?
Well, if you read the Sumerian myths, and this is one of the things that really struck me about these texts, they have a very modern, plausible feel to them. There are basically two stages to this war. These tablets of destinies were something that the texts themselves indicate conferred such an awesome technological power on whoever possessed them, that when they were stolen by various gods within the Sumerian pantheon, the immediate result of that theft was that the side that they were stolen from went to war to recover them. So in other words, it's kind of the ancient Sumerian analog to what we find going on in the world today. You know, there's all the concern about the proliferation of nuclear and thermonuclear weapons, and that certain world powers are wanting to stop that proliferation and willing to go, or threaten to go, to war to prevent it. So it has a very modern feel to it. You sense that there's something plausible and real going on in these texts, however garbled they may be in their actual account of the actual war. But essentially, what I come to the conclusion as far as the physics of what these things may have been that could have conferred such an awesome power, I kind of come to a speculative conclusion that I argue in one whole chapter of the book that's dedicated to this question, that these things formed, so to speak, the software that made their ancient weapons of mass destruction actually work. So in other words, you couldn't work this technology without possession of these things. And essentially, I think that what they were kind of the catalogs to what's called a phase conjugate mirror of local celestial bodies that were of importance to that civilization. Now, to give your listeners kind of an idea of what a phase conjugate mirror is, every celestial body leaves a kind of signature in the geometry of space-time, which, again, is a constantly changing sort of geometry. But that signature will kind of remain basic to that particular celestial body, no matter what the geometry does. So scientists have discovered recently that if you fire a laser beam to an object and then mix it in a kind of a special mirror, this mirror will remove any distortions that occur between the target and the place that the mirror is being shot to, and that you can then create a kind of a hologram, which if you fire the laser beam through the grating that's created by the hologram, the energy will appear at that specific target completely undissipated with tremendous power and force. And I think something like this is actually in play with these tablets of destinies. And the reason I stress the celestial connection is that, again, over and over in these ancient texts and in these ancient civilizations, you have the astrological element, that there is some profound hint that there's more going on with their science than the kind of astrology that we're used to in the tabloids, you know, that we pick up in the supermarket.
Now, you're saying that this technology with the firing the laser and creating the hologram with the grid and so forth actually exists today.
Well, that's that's the Pandora's box there, Kevin. One of the strange things that these texts indicate, and permit me to go a little bit into detail on this one,
sure,
because it's such an excellent question. One of the texts that I examine at great length in the Cosmic War is an ancient Sumerian epic called The Exploits of Ninurta. Now, this is actually an epic that Sitchin refers to in some of his books, but he doesn't really quote at any great length from it. He kind of hints at it. But I reproduce the actual text at some length, because what the text is at the end of the second phase of this war, these objects are stolen, again, from someone else who had stolen them, and an inventory is made of what these things are. So in other words, you're sitting there reading this mythological text, and it's the effect is created that you're kind of sitting down and reading the index of a Sears catalog. It's a very boring, dry text. It's nothing but a catalog of what these things were. And in the process of this inventory, there are several individual components of this stolen technology that are mentioned, and then different things are decided about what to do with it. For example, some of these things are removed from the hardware and taken elsewhere and used in other ways. Some of the things are simply destroyed so that they could not be used again. And then there's a special third category that I find extremely interesting, that some of these things that could not be destroyed were removed and hidden. And it's that last little category that I find very fascinating, because if you follow all of the indicators in the texts, where they were hidden would be places like Egypt, modern-day Iraq, and even very possibly Mars or the Moon. So, you know, astonishing as that is, what it really indicates is that something, again, very similar to what the Allies did with Nazi Germany at the end of World War II. We sent in intelligence teams. We scoured the Third Reich for all of its patents and so on and so forth. And we hauled them off for ourselves and then told the Germans, now, don't be using any of this stuff ever again. So, mm-hmm. You know, it has that modern feel to it that, again, is quite catching when you sit down and actually think about what's being said. So, you know, that puts a whole kind of different spin on what we may actually be doing in the middle of, in the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq, because, you know, prior to our invasion of the country, the French and the Germans had teams of archaeologists there on the invitation of Saddam Hussein, scratching and digging in the desert for him, and when we invaded, we told them to get out, we're coming in. So, you know, if there were weapons of mass destruction in play in Iraq, you know, one of the speculations I entertain is that that technology may have actually been a very ancient one that we were really concerned about. So this spins out in any number of ways that are very, very interesting.
Well, that's, yeah, very interesting is one way to put that. Now, in the book, you talk about evidence on the planets mm-hmm. of some planet-busting technology mm-hmm. That was used in this war. Mm-hmm. We've got about, 8 minutes or so before we have to take a break, so let's dive off into that. What kind of evidence exists that such a war actually took place?
Well, the strongest evidence, really, is the asteroid belt itself, because there is within modern astronomy the revival of a hypothesis that was really put forward at the beginning of the 19th century called the exploded planet hypothesis. The man that's revived this in modern times is a fellow by the name of Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who used to be an astronomer for the U.S. Naval Observatory. And basically what he does in his book, a very good book called Dark Matter, Missing Planets and New Comets, is that he examines the geological evidence of the asteroids and comes to the conclusion, like the astronomers back in the 18th and early 19th century, that this asteroid belt was in fact a planet that had exploded. It had blown up. Now, the problem with the model, Kevin, is that Van Flandern examines a number of different proposals, all based kind of in a naturalistic assumption, that this planet blew up from. And he even comes to the idea that, you know, there was perhaps even some matter-antimatter reaction that occurred in the inside of the planet and blew it up. So in other words, he's really grasping at straws, if you look at it in a certain way, if you look at it from the standpoint of the physics of it. The problem with all these models is that they really don't work. He entertains the idea of collisions, you know, as does Zechariah Sitchin and so many catastrophists. But the problem with a celestial body colliding with a planet is that in order to blow a planet that large up, you would have to have another fairly large celestial body slamming into it, and that in turn would leave orbital perturbations on the orbits of the rest of the planets in the solar system. It would be very akin to putting little toy boats in a pond and then tossing a great big boulder into the pond and watching what happens to the planet or to the boats. They're all going to bob up and down and show signs that a rock has been thrown into the mix. The problem is, then, that we don't see that type of signature on the remaining planets in the solar system. So Van Flandern himself comes down in one place in the book, and I mention this in The Cosmic War. He finally comes down to admitting the possibility that we have to consider that this may have happened by, quote, deliberate action, unquote. And those are his words. In other words, he's implying that this happened as an act of a technology and therefore possibly as an act of war. Now, once we've said that, again, we have to look at what the texts that imply a similar type of celestial event have to say. Do they contain a physics sufficient to blowing up a planet in a kind of a Star Wars Death Star type scenario? And this is where it gets very interesting, because again and again, when you read these texts, it's very clear that they contain kind of watered-down descriptions of precisely what the physics would be that would be necessary to do that. So again, all the clues are there that we may be looking at a very, very real war that was extremely destructive, that was fought in our own celestial neighborhood.
Does all of this give us any clue as to who was doing the fighting?
Ah, another $64,000 question.
Well, good.
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, this is the funny thing about these texts. Essentially what they kind of describe is a kind of a civil war, or better put, if you look at the Sumerian texts in particular, it's a war between one side of the pantheon against another. And of course, they're all interrelated. And the idea that I draw the analogy to would be World War I, where you have the royal houses of Europe, the von Hohenzollerns, the von Habsburgs, the Romanovs, the Windsors in England, and so on. You have all the royal houses of Europe essentially going to war with each other, and yet when you look at their family trees, they're all related to each other.
Yeah, so, big family,
you know,
fight.
It's a big gruesome, grisly, barbaric family fight. And this is kind of what you see actually taking place in these ancient texts. You see a big, huge, gruesome family fight. It's a kind of a civil war within one great big kind of interplanetary civilization.
And, you know, one of the interesting things, you do the genealogy of those gods.
Right.
And
right.
It shows, you know, it's brothers, sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles, mothers and daddies.
Right.
All fighting each other, stealing from each other. Great family.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a wonderful group of people. And you examine the actions of these characters on either side of this war, and you know, you have to kind of come to the conclusion that these people have the morality of gnats. I mean, they just have no real conception of the sanctity of life or anything like that. And the most peculiar thing about these genealogies is that if you put mankind into that context, he's sort of caught in the middle between these two warring factions. So, you know, that puts an added dimension to the story because, you know, according to the Sumerian legend and even in the biblical text to a certain extent, you get the idea that at some point in humanity's distant past, these beings, whatever or whoever they were, had some sort of intermingling, interbreeding genetic relationship with humanity. In other words, we might be looking at our long-lost interstellar distant cousins, you know, that are part of the genus Homo sapiens, but they might be not Homo sapiens sapiens, but Homo sapiens something else, you know, in order for that interbreeding to take place. So it's a very, very complex subject.
All right, we're only about a minute away from break,
sure.
But, you know, we see, I'll go ahead and set this up, and we'll get into it in some depth on the other side of the break. But we see photographs from the moon, we see photographs from Mars that seem to show artificial structures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I would go beyond saying seem to show. The ones from Hale Crater,
yeah,
on Mars show what appears to be a very large city,
mm-hmm,
in that crater. And there are a lot of structures in that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
What I want us to get into on the other side of the break, I want to ask the question of about those civilizations that appear to have been there. Are they who were fighting, or are those victims of the ones who were doing the fighting? And we'll get into that when we come back from this break. All right, folks, we're listening to the author of one of the best books I've read in a long time, Dr. Joseph Farrell, and the book is called The Cosmic War. Was there one? What's the evidence for it? And what does the future look like? Did they all get wiped out, or are they coming back? We'll come back right after this. Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet? No? Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today. We are talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell. He is the author of a book called The Cosmic War. And before we went away for break, Dr. Farrell, I posed a question. And the question is, when we look at these photographs and we see what looks like structures, artificial structures on the moon and on Mars, are we looking at the ruins of civilizations that were victims of this war? Are we looking at the ruins of civilizations that participated in the war, or are we not looking at ruins of civilizations?
Well, the answer, the short answer to all of that is yes. I think we are looking at not only the victims, but to a certain extent the participants in that war. And, you know, the interesting thing about this work is that it dovetails so very neatly into the work of people like Richard Hoagland that have been discussing and documenting their case for these things being actually artificial for any number of years and doing it with some scientific rigor. In Mars' case particularly, I think that we see evidence not only of a victim in that war, but of a participant. And one of the reasons I say that is that there is a passage from Mr. Hoagland's first book, The Monuments of Mars, that refers to the D&M pyramid, this very large pyramidal structure, five-sided structure at Cydonia, in which there is evidence, if you examine the photographs that NASA's made public correctly and carefully, there is evidence that this structure was in fact targeted, and he makes it very clear that the type of weapon that would have been capable of this type of damage that you see in evidence is a massively powerful sort of particle beam weapon or plasma discharge. So, in other words, we are looking at, I think, in the case of Mars specifically, at something that appears to have been a target in this war. Now, the reason I find that so very interesting, Kevin, is that in the text that I examine, if you look at the names of the gods that are referred to carefully, Mars is always a player in this war, a very major player. So again, I think we're looking at a civilization then, based on the textual evidence, that is taking place, a war that's taking place, between the Earth, Moon, Mars, and this missing planet, and possibly the satellites of Jupiter and Saturn as well. That's at the minimum. This is what the texts themselves imply, if you read them in this way.
Do we have any idea, any information or details about the civilization that would have been on the Moon or the civilization that would have been on Mars?
Well, beyond the fact that this is part of this wider civilization, we don't have much details other than to say that certain of the gods that are associated with those celestial bodies appear to be fighting certain other gods at various times that have their base in the Earth-Moon system. So in other words, if we kind of want to extrapolate a bit from the evidence of the text, I think what we're looking at is a war that has the Earth and the Moon at least on one side of this conflict, and Mars, the missing planet, Jupiter and Saturn on the other. And the peculiar thing about Mars is that if you really pay attention to the text, I don't mention this actually in the book, but I kind of hint at it in all of my books. If you look at Mars, it appears that you have a planet that switched sides at some point in the war, and as a result of that, paid the price from somebody. So, you know, it again is something that I think we have to put in the wider context, not only of the text, but like you say, all of these photographs that indicate that there are indeed some sort of artificial structures on these nearby celestial neighbors. And that really kind of puts our space race, you know, this new race to get back to the Moon, in a kind of a unique perspective.
You know, one of the interesting things that has hit the Internet, and I'll preface this by saying that all the indicators are that it may be a hoax, okay? On the other hand, there's no definitive proof that it is a hoax yet, that would be the series of videos that have been released by a person calling himself William Rutledge. Are you familiar with those?
No. What is it that you're referring to would be a hoax?
Okay. Well, William Rutledge, and we'll use the name. I have no way of knowing if that is this person's real name, mm-hmm. Is purporting to be retired and formerly a contract test pilot for the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in his videos and in the little explanations and information about the videos and in an interview that he gave an Italian journalist that he was the commander of a secret mission to the moon that was flown using the Apollo equipment. He says it was Apollo 20, but it was flown secretly out of Vandenberg. The videos of this mission show, taking a look at the astronauts walking through the ruins of a huge building at a ruined city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether all that is going to turn out to be a hoax or if it's real. I don't know. But apparently there are ruined cities on the moon, not using his photographs, but using other NASA photographs, they can be seen.
Oh, yes, definitely. I would definitely concur with that. I don't know this Mr. Rutledge nor what he's posted on the internet. I'll certainly probably look at it after the show. But, the whole premise of Mr. Hoagland's more recent book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, has been to do a detailed examination of the actual Apollo photographs that NASA itself has released. And there, to my mind, is a solid scientific case that is made in that book that these photographs are indeed genuine. And when you do the sort of image rectifying processing that he does on these images, you can see these things very clearly hanging and hovering in the air in the publicly released photographs. So there's no question to my mind that this is in fact the case, that there is a technology on the moon, and that, as he put it, the real reason that we canceled the Apollo project, the rest of the missions that remained in the series, was that we in fact had accomplished the mission, which was in effect to go to the moon and attempt to recover and bring back to Earth some of this technology. Now, the whole problem that this implies is that we knew that it had to have been there prior to going. So that raises the question, well, who knew and when did they know it? And how? And more importantly, how did they know?
Exactly.
Yeah, and to my mind, I think that the real explanation has to lie in the fact that somebody for a very long time, particularly toward the beginning of the 20th century, was putting these ancient texts together and looking at them in a very similar way to what I do in the Cosmic War. And the one place where you find that sort of thinking informing almost every aspect of hidden off-the-books projects is, unfortunately, Nazi Germany. So that kind of puts the presence of all those German rocket scientists inside of NASA into a very different perspective as well. And, just to mention one more fact that I found, you mentioned reading my book several times. Well, I had to sit down and read Mr. Hoagland's twice, because the first reading I just was really flabbergasted, and I reread the book. But one of the things that he mentions is that a couple of the Apollo missions were actually landed on the moon on Hitler's birthday. Now, you know as well as I do, Kevin, that in order to plan a mission, you have to plan it months in advance and down to the last detail of timing. So, in other words, landing on the moon on that particular date is hardly accidental. It requires planning. So, that, again, puts the presence of these paperclip Nazis inside of NASA into a very interesting light, because what it means or implies is that this influence that they had at that time in NASA is very extensive and very powerful. So again, you know, we're looking at, to my mind, at the very real prospect that there is a hidden agenda at work here, and it was known at least since World War II.
Do you think it would have been known generally at NASA, or do you think it would have been knowledge held in the hands and minds of just a few?
I think it was knowledge that was closely held, as you indicate, in the hands of a very, very few group of people and scientists at the top. The Nazis certainly would have been some of them. If I can just kind of go off on a slight tangent here. In the book that I published prior to Cosmic War, it's a book called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and the subtitle of that is NASA's Nazis, JFK, and Magic 12.
I hate to do it. We're going to have to get the rest of that after the break. It's taking over. It'll cut our mics off. All right, folks, stay tuned. We've got some really interesting stuff coming up, more interesting stuff, and in the next hour, we'll take your calls. Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com. Folks, don't forget, if you haven't done so, get over to KevinSmithShow.com and subscribe to our free weekly newsletter, our free weekly e-zine. It's called the K-Files e-zine, all right? It takes about 10 seconds. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. We're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we're talking about the cosmic war.
Now, when we went away for break, Dr. Farrell, you were just beginning to... I've been on the edge of the chair all through the break. You were just beginning to get into the Nazi technology and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell.
Well, yeah, that book is the book that's previous to the Cosmic War, and in it I mentioned this Bell project of the Nazis, and very briefly, what that was a project that has every appearance of having been a prototypical field propulsion, or if you will, anti-gravity technology, a quite successful project. But the interesting thing about the project is that the man who designed the power plant for this thing was a fellow by the name of Dr. Kurt Davis. And he was, as I document in the book, an ardent Nazi. Well, he's one of the people that is brought over as part of Operation Paperclip, and he ends up in NASA beginning in 1963 and all the way through the Apollo missions as a senior flight director at Cape Canaveral at the Kennedy Space Center. But the interesting thing about this man is that he's not even a rocket scientist. I reproduce a picture of him in that book standing next to Dr. von Braun at NASA. But he's not even a rocket scientist, Kevin. He's actually an electrical engineer whose specialty is in high voltage discharge and measurement. So, you know, the question that occurs inevitably is, what is he doing in that position? Why is he there? And why was he connected with the Third Reich's most sensitive wartime secret weapons project? I mean, they had this thing classified higher than the atomic bomb. Well, one of the things I suggest in the book is that he's there, his presence there, suggests that there may have been an alternative technology in play during the Apollo missions. So in other words, this is a very complex question. But I do think that that the indicators are that we are looking not only at a covert agenda for going there, but I think that we're looking at a covert technology that may have been in play to get us there, and more importantly, get us off the moon once we were there.
So are you saying then that what really took the astronauts to the moon was not the Saturn V rocket, and what got us off the moon was not the rockets from the lunar landing module?
Well, I'm not saying it's an alternative technology that got us there. I think that the Saturn V is the workhorse that got us there. But what got us off the moon, what has always been mentioned by the Apollo hoaxers, and let me be very clear, I'm not in that camp. I do believe we went. But one of the things that they've always pointed out, and that I've always found peculiar myself, is if you look at those television films and shots of the limb taking off from the moon, you see an acceleration that does not happen like a rocket. A rocket accelerates geometrically. It goes a little further per unit of time. But what you see the limb do is it just sort of pops up and flies away at a more or less constant velocity. Now, to me...
Well, now, let me ask this.
Sure.
Could that not be because of the lower gravity?
Ah, but this is the problem. One of the most peculiar mysteries of the Apollo program is that shortly after our first successful moon landing, Dr. von Braun gave an interview for Time magazine about 2 weeks later. And in the interview, he quotes a neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon as having been approximately 43,500 some odd miles from the surface of the Moon. Now, when you do the math, that means that the Moon is a much more massive object than we have been told its 1/6 gravity to be. If it were the gravity of 1/6 of the Earth, the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon would have been something like 23,000 miles from the surface of the Moon.
So the gravity is approximately double what we've been told.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you do the calculations, the mass of the moon turns out to be about 60% of the Earth, which means it's a very massive object, given its size. And it has many other very, very peculiar properties as well. But the interesting thing about this interview is that for some inexplicable reason, Dr. von Braun, I think a period about a week to 2 weeks after this interview, he suddenly resigned all of his positions inside of NASA and went to work for private industry. He went to work for Fairchild Industries. Now, there's never been an adequate explanation of that, Kevin. Why did he do that? Well, my guess is, and it's pure speculation, but my guess is that when he let out that figure for the neutral point, he let something slip that he should not have, and that he was forced to resign. Because what that figure means is that, in all likelihood, that little rocket that was on the limb, on the lunar excursion module, was probably not sufficient to get us off the moon once we got there. And there's where your alternative technology may have been in play. And again, I'm stressing that this is all highly speculative based on some of the circumstantial evidence. But nonetheless, it's there and it bears mentioning.
One of the things that people have pointed out, too, is that there should have been more of a crater created by that rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of dust kicked up, and
right.
That didn't happen.
Well, that's the other problem. And, you know, according to the standard model, and I'm going to cite Richard Hoagland's words here because they're very apt to the problem, you know, the moon supposedly has been formed by a geological process of incessant meteoric rain, of tiny particles beating down on it almost every second of its existence, sculpting a very smooth, rounded landscape. And according to that model, what you should have is inches of dust. But when our astronauts got to the moon and actually performed some of those core drilling samples that they were doing up there, they discovered that they had only to go a very few inches into the surface before the moon became very, very hard. In fact, some of the core samples they were bringing back were things like titanium and beryllium and, you know, all these very exotic, very hard metals. So, you know, this is the other mystery. The standard model really just does not work for the moon in almost any way that you look at it. And when you add to this the fact that you can see clear evidence or indicators of artificial structures on the moon, not only in NASA photographs, but he reproduces some very interesting Soviet photographs as well, that, you know, the thing adds up that there has to be some other agenda in play in both of those nations' programs to get to the moon.
If I understand what you're saying that there was prior knowledge. Yes. Prior to going to the moon, there was knowledge at NASA that there was ancient high technology on the moon.
Yes, yes. I definitely believe that the signs point in that direction, yes. There really is no good explanation otherwise for why we would have suddenly canceled the Apollo program unless we had found what we were looking for. And I think that really is kind of the key, you know, to the sudden and very mysterious cancellation after Apollo 17 of the rest of the missions. I think basically it was mission accomplished.
We had Richard Hoagland here not too long ago as
uh-huh.
my guest.
Uh-huh.
He talked about this at some length and talked about finding a robot head
uh-huh.
on the moon, and he's got a picture of it on his website.
Yep.
It looks just like 3CPO.
Yep, it does. It does.
So you've seen it.
Oh, yes. Mr. Hoagland and I have been in a regular contact, really, since Cosmic War came out. It kind of was a contact that had been brokered by a mutual friend of ours, but we've been in regular contact since then because, basically, you know, when I wrote SS Brotherhood of the Bell on Cosmic War, I was doing so completely independently of what he was writing in Dark Mission, and, you know, the two approaches dovetail so very neatly together. together. And this this is kind of the astonishing thing to both of us, is that we could be coming to so many similar conclusions, but approaching it from a slightly different point of historical point of view and scientific point of view.
All right, our top of the hour break is upon us, and it's going to take over in 2 seconds. Well, less than. There it is. When we come back, we'll open up the telephone lines, and I also would like to sort of get into the question of, were there survivors of this war? Are they still around, and are they coming back? Is that what we're seeing in the skies now? We'll be back.
Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
Let me welcome all of you who are joining us just now in this second hour of the Kevin Smith Show. Man, have you missed a great first hour. We're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we're talking about his research into and his book about the cosmic war. And, man, what information we are getting. Dr. Farrell, we have callers lined up, so let's go to the phone line and take the first call. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, yes, it's Kevin from Iroquois Falls, Ontario.
Kevin, you made it to the first slot again.
Well, want me to tell you my secret for that? Or
No.
No, okay.
No.
Hello, Joseph. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I've researched a lot on the ancient astronaut theory, of course, and a lot about Sitchin and whatnot. And I think, you know, there was a war in the heavens back, way back when, you know, the cosmic wars. And I wanted to know who you thought were involved in that conflict. I think I personally believe that the Anunnaki were definitely one of them. And I'm thinking maybe the Greys might have been the opponent in that conflict. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I stick exclusively to textual evidence. In other words, I do not invoke ETs or UFOs in the standard sense. So I don't get into questions of Greys or reptilians or any of that, because, again, there's nothing in the textual evidence to indicate that this is what's going on. That being said, I do agree that the Sumerian texts that I refer to extensively in the book indicate that these Anunnaki, whoever they were, had some sort of role in this war. And more importantly, they indicate that they had some sort of role either in the formation of mankind or the manipulation of mankind genetically. So, yeah, as far as one of the participants goes, you would definitely have that group involved.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. 1-800-289-1092 is the number to call. It's toll-free throughout all of North America. If you live outside of North America and you have a question or comment, all you need to do is send an email to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. I will read it on the air, and we'll ask Dr. Farrell to comment about it, all right? So once again, it's flash@kevinsmithshow.com. Now, if you can't remember that, you know there's a link on my website. So just go to kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down. You'll see the little article about tonight's show. You'll see Dr. Farrell's picture. At the bottom of that, there's the link, all right? What about these beings, whoever they were, whatever they were, that were in this war? Did any survive?
Well, this is another Pandora's box. The texts indicate that, yes, some of them did survive. As to whether or not they're still around, I think we have to entertain the idea that they might be, simply because if we're dealing with a technology that is as sophisticated as I believe the texts indicate it to be, then we would have to also accept the fact that they would have a similar technology in terms of medicine and genetics and so on. And we might be looking at something that is still out there. And I definitely entertain the possibility.
Is there any indication in the text that who wound up with these tablets of destiny, the remaining parts?
Oh, yes, definitely there is. The fellow that conducted the inventory that I referred to in the first hour is a Sumerian god by the name of Ninurta. And as I also indicate, and as the texts are very clear in indicating, some of that technology at least survived the last phase of that war. And as they indicate, some of that technology was indestructible. In other words, it could not be destroyed, even though they may have wanted to do so. So that technology itself may still be lying under the sands and silts of Iraq or Egypt or very possibly Mars or the moon. So, again, we're looking at a very, very ancient, very deep agenda that may be in play in the modern space programs.
All right. Now, if some of them survived, and of course I realize that I'm really asking you to speculate here, but...
Sure.
If some of them survived, and if the civilizations, the remains of which we see in photographs from Mars, if those were civilizations that participated in the war, is it possible that some of them survived?
Well, that's very interesting. I live in the northern Black Hills of South Dakota. And we had a big, huge gold mine here by the name of Homestead Gold Mine, which they're now converting into a big underground scientific laboratory because some of the mine shafts go about 8,000 feet deep. And I just read an article in a local paper that one of the scientists involved with this project is exploring the idea of looking for life in those very extreme underground pressures. And he entertains this as specifically in reference to the question of whether or not there might be life on Mars under the surface in similar conditions. So, you know, we have to entertain the possibility because, as Mr. Hoagland and others have pointed out so many times, the conditions on Mars appear to have been able to support life in the past. And certainly when you add to that the fact that there definitely are some artificial structures there, somebody was living there. So we have to entertain the idea that someone may still be living there. And, you know, one of the interesting things I mentioned in the Cosmic War are the Soviet losses of their Phobos 2 probe. And I reproduce these pictures that the Soviet Union released to the United States after they lost this probe. What the pictures show is that prior to its loss, there appears to have been some sort of artificial construct or object in orbit above Mars with the Soviet probe, and the speculation is, of course, that it was taken out. So there may still be somebody there for all we know.
You know, I don't know, what, about 4 or 5 months ago, they released these photographs, NASA released these photographs, of these giant holes in Mars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are 7 of them. At least that's what they said.
Mm-hmm.
There are 7 of them. And they are just huge, giant, apparently very deep holes,
mm-hmm,
in Mars. And they're not small. You could fly a sizable aircraft into one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know we're talking speculatively, but you're talking about these mine shafts.
Right.
It would seem to me, based on what you're saying, and then based also upon the size of the holes in Mars, that they could have escaped into the inside of Mars, and perhaps there's a thriving civilization in there.
Well, perhaps there is, and one of the things we have to consider in that respect is that if we are looking at artificial structures, for example, at Cydonia, with the face, with the D&M pyramid, and some of the other strange things that are there, and I believe we are looking at artificial structures, then we are looking at a civilization that certainly had the engineering capability to build things on a vast scale. I mean, these structures, Kevin, absolutely dwarf anything that we find on Earth. So if we're looking at that, then we have to entertain the possibility that we may consider that they had the ability to build an underground civilization. And in that respect, it's important to remember that one of the things that the Russian scientists maintained on the basis of some of their radar tomography of Mars was, and you can find some of these pictures on Mr. Hoagland's site and in his Mars Monuments book, one of the things that they maintain is that the rectilinearity of some of these things underneath the surface of Mars have all the appearance of being not only artificial structures, but whole cities. So again, and that's the Soviet scientists' word for these things. They come right out and say that these look like cities. So we have to maintain the possibility, I think, on the basis of the evidence that's available to us.
All right, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, sure. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Yes, Mark.
Hi, Dr. Farrell.
Hi, Mark.
In the past year, I've learned so much from people like yourself. However, you know, I feel a bit of frustration because it seems that we in the public, that we've been lied to, or at the very least, so much important information has been...
Yes.
Withheld from us. Would you agree that much of what we have been taught about our history and science is, in fact, maybe bogus, or maybe the best word is incomplete?
Oh, boy. short answer, yes. I think that there's actually two tracks to your question. You mentioned science on the one hand and history on the other. I think that in terms of the history, the lies really begin to occur just in the final, say, 6 to 8 months of World War II. Because if you examine some of the operational deployments of the end of the war and look at them from a military standpoint, they just don't make sense on either side. So I think the lies begin there. I think there's definite scientific and technological reasons for those historical mysteries. As far as the science goes, I think that we're looking at a real possibility of there having been, for at least the time period since James Clerk Maxwell back in the middle of the 19th century, we're looking at the very real possibility that there has been a deliberate effort to lead public consumption physics into certain dead ends that could not be technologically exploited and challenge the geopolitical and economic status quo. In other words, I think we have to entertain the real possibility that there has been under development, under analysis and scrutiny for that period of time, and off the books physics, and off the books technology developed from it. And again, I have to go back to Nazi Germany with this Bell project, because this is the clearest indicator, to my mind, that these things took place. And, of course, the famous case of Nikola Tesla would be another. So, yeah, I think you're correct in saying that. It is a massive public disinformation effort, I think, that's been underway.
Well, I'd like to thank you for your work and also for Kevin's show here for getting this information out. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks for the call. 1-800-289-1092 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for Dr. Farrell. Let me recommend also that you get this book. And let's just go ahead and tell folks where they can get it, Dr. Farrell.
Sure. They can contact the publisher directly. That's Adventures Unlimited Press, and they can go online to www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. That's all one word. It's all lowercase. Or they can go to their Barnes & Noble or Amazon. If they want to call the publisher, that's 1-800-718-4514. And please call during normal business hours, folks. It's a small publishing house, so we don't want to wake them up there. But all my books are $16.95. Cosmic War is $18.95. And there is a discount on orders of three or more books.
All right, and we'll give that information again later in the show. So if you didn't get that, get your pencil and paper ready. And when we give that again, you can write it down. Flash message has lit up, and we've got a flash message from Australia from Phil, and he wants to know, he says, does all this lend any weight to Ron Hubbard's story?
I'm not familiar with his story. You'll have to clue me in here.
I'm not either. So,
oh, okay.
I don't know. Okay, so the answer is, Phil, we don't know. Could be, but we don't know. Whenever we talk about, I know you don't like to talk about extraterrestrials and so forth, but then it depends on how that gets defined.
Right.
If they're not from here, they are extraterrestrial.
Right, right.
And so very obviously, the theory that you put forth is about a war between extraterrestrials and perhaps some terrestrials.
Right, right.
We find bits of technology here in layers, in strata, that's millions of years old.
Right.
And that technology, for instance, there are some it looks like billiard balls.
Yeah.
Some spheres that were discovered, and I can't remember. I think it's like, I don't know, 600 million years old or 300 million years old, something phenomenal like that. And they all have very precise grooves, three right. of them, etched around the equator of right. the sphere. Right. And they are etched with precision that would take a diamond tip to do.
Right, right. Well, let's go back to something I said in the first hour. I'm not opposed to the idea of extraterrestrials, but I think, you know, from what the evidence suggests, and it's a question really that I've considered throughout all of my books, and I first mention it explicitly in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, in fact, because the evidence seems to point to the fact that we have distant cousins. And I meant what I said in the first hour. If we look at our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, it would appear that we have cousins out there in the genus Homo sapiens itself. In other words, humanity may have an extent in some form or another in the universe, in the galaxy, that we simply are unaware of. And this would explain then why we can find textual references in the Sumerian texts and in other ancient texts of these gods, whoever they were, being able to come down and actually interbreed with us, because genetically, in order for that to happen, you have to have a certain genetic commonality. You know, we don't interbreed with dogs, and so on and so forth. So the idea that's hinted at there is that we have some distant cousins in the universe somewhere, and I think that may be, in fact, what we're ultimately dealing with here.
All right, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, sure. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's Charles in Albuquerque.
Yes, Charles.
And really interesting show tonight. Sounds like a dynamite book. I'm going to have to get a copy of this.
It is dynamite. Believe me, it is a mind blower.
And I'm just sitting here chatting with another member on the chat line while we're listening, and we both wondered if you'd heard of the evidence of atomic blasts in the past, like atomic glass in India?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
I'll let one you comment on that if you had to.
Sure. One of the interesting things in Zechariah Sitchin's scenario that got me started investigating all of this, actually, was the comment that he made that a war was fought to destroy a horrendous weapon of mass destruction in ancient times, and the weapon turned out to be the Great Pyramid. But the side that was opposing this technology resorted to the use of nuclear weapons. Now, this is very interesting because in the southwest Egyptian desert, there is an area of the desert there called the Libyan Desert Glass. And this is an area where the entire desert floor is fused in a kind of a green glass silicate, very much like you would find at the Trinity site in New Mexico. The Indian site that you're referring to is actually a city that's in now modern-day Pakistan. It used to be part of the British Raj. It's called Mohenjo-Daro. And this city, you can go there and see human skeletons, you know, doing ordinary day-to-day tasks that have been melted and fused into the stone of the city walls and streets and so on and so forth. The city itself looks like it was subjected to sudden, immensely high heat. The Soviet scientists back in the 1950s actually sent an expedition there, and they measured a background radiation that was similar to that in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So in other words, you have these places around the world where there is every sign of some sort of nuclear weapon or perhaps a plasma discharge weapon of having been used at some point in a vastly destructive war.
The place you're talking about in India, I've read about it, and I have read that that dates to around 25,000 B.C.
Yes, that's correct. That's quite true. And this is the other mystery, because, you know, even in Iraq, if you dig down far enough into the sands and silts of Iraq, you'll come to another layer of this fused green silicate glass again, and it's in a strata that would date it to about 8 to 10,000 B.C. So in other words, you can find these things all over the world, and this hints again at something that I mentioned in the Cosmic War, that these civilizations that you find in India, the Vedic civilization, the Sumerian, the Egyptian, all of these civilizations have one thing in common, and that is they maintain that they are the declined legacies of something that was much more sophisticated and that pre-existed them by millennia. So again, I think the evidence is sufficient that we have to take some of these ideas very seriously indeed.
All right. Now, that would mean that if we've got this place in India with evidence of a nuclear blast at 25,000 B.C., you've got it in Iraq at 8 to 10,000. You've got it in other places at various other dates. It would seem that this was a very, very, very long war.
Oh, yes, definitely. And one of the things I point out in the Cosmic War is if you take the dates implied by the texts and then the date implied by the exploded planet hypothesis, you're looking at something that at the minimum began about 3.2 million years ago. So in other words, this is a very long, very protracted conflict, and it raises certain questions, not only about the civilization that is involved in this war, but about the longevity of the people that are behind it. And again, you know, the texts themselves are clear when you consult them. You can consult the Bible, you can consult the Sumerian texts, the Egyptian texts, and so on. They all maintain that whoever these people were, they lived a lot longer than we do today.
Well, when you consult the Bible, the earliest people lived a lot longer than we do today. And there are two places in the Bible where it says that our genetics were altered to make us live shorter.
Right, right.
It doesn't say genetics. It says that God decided we were living too long, and he lowered it to 120 years, and then later to 70 years.
Right, right. And I think that this, too, is a possible component in this war, namely, that if you have, let's assume, the ability of humans to live, say, hundreds, if not thousands of years, then this would mean that the whole cycle of the acquisition and impartation of knowledge via education and so on would be drastically different. You would be able to accomplish in one generation whole scientific revolutions. And not only that, you would have people with a much broader personal base of knowledge than you find today. So in other words, if you view it in the context of the cosmic war, this appears to have been a kind of a guerrilla warfare decision to inhibit the kind of developments of these technologies, or at least delay them significantly.
What if part of what could not be destroyed was us?
And that may very well be.
And instead of destroying, someone put in a genetic firewall.
Yeah, that's interesting because, Kevin, when I was doing the research for this book, I ran across similar ideas when I was researching aspects of the Human Genome Project. And I didn't mention them because I wasn't able sufficiently, to my mind, to pin down the modern-day science that would be involved with it. But there are ideas out there like that circulating, so I don't find it an implausible suggestion at all.
In the early days of when the Human Genome Project began releasing press releases about what they had found and so forth, there was a press release that said that they had discovered that we humans have 223 genes that have no evolutionary precursors.
Right.
That means they're not from this planet.
Well, it's either that or they have been deliberately engineered into the DNA sequence. It's one or the other.
Either way, it's not from here.
Either way, it's an indicator that there's an artificiality to the modern day human being that is really beyond the models of science to explain.
All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Joseph Farrell and your calls at 1-800-289-1092.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
We're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we're talking about the cosmic war. And the telephone line is open. If you have a comment or question, anywhere in North America, it's toll-free, 1-800-289-1092.
Dr. Farrell, when we went away, we were talking about the genetics.
Right.
And one of the things that your comments caused me to think of is a statement, we have met the enemy, and the enemy is us.
Us. Yeah. Yeah, this would definitely appear to be the case that's suggested by the texts themselves. It's really something that, you know, like you said, it's a mystery. And the junk DNA that you referred to, that those 223 chromosomes, they really do not have a sufficient model within modern genetics to explain these things. I just was unable to actually talk about them at any great length because I wasn't able to pin down any more in the literature I was able to research. But
they did go quiet about that very quickly.
Oh, yeah, they sure did. Mm-hmm. They sure did.
You know, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that Richard Hoagland has a theory that we are the Martians, that we are the remnants of that civilization.
Yes.
Dr. Bruce Cornett has a theory that it's the other way, that we are that the Martians are us.
Right.
That the civilization that was on Mars and that died out was us.
Right.
Your theory seems to say it could go either way.
Well, yeah, in the book I try to avoid pinning it down to those kinds of details. I try and paint in very broad strokes, and at the state of evidence, at least as far as I've been able to take it and research it, yeah, it could go either way. My leaning is probably toward the fact that they, whoever they were on Mars, are us in that sense. In other words, that somehow whoever interfered with Earth's prehistory built a civilization, and mankind somehow was taken there. That's kind of the way I lean right now, although I certainly hold open the other possibility.
Therefore, if either of those theories is correct,
uh-huh,
when we finally put men on Mars, and there are people who say it's already been done.
Right.
But when we finally officially and publicly put humans on Mars,
right,
it is possible they are going to find skeletal remains that look like us.
It's very, very possible. I think I think when we consider all the evidence that we've talked about in the show previously, that we have to be open to that possibility.
Do you think that we already are there?
Well, a very, very good question. To be quite honest with you, I have to hold open the possibility for the following reason. Recently, the explosion of the comet Holmes, which you may or may not remember,
mm-hmm,
to my mind, that has all the signatures of a technology at work. And if it's that sophisticated a technology that can do that, then somebody somewhere has a technology that's probably capable, if it's us, of getting there and back. So again, I have to hold open the possibility. And if we consider the fact, again, that there was this Nazi scientist involved with the Apollo project as a senior flight director at Cape Kennedy, who was working on this Bell device, which very clearly was a field propulsion experimental device, then we have to hold open the possibility that in the 60 years since the end of World War II, that technology could certainly have been developed far beyond anything that the record indicates.
When you say that the explosion of the comet Holmes has all the earmarks of technology having caused it, what are you referring to?
Well, I'm referring to the fact that when you look at the data, the measurements of the sudden expansion of that comet, the expansion has the signature of an explosion. Now, to my mind, examining the data, there does not appear to have been a collision of that comet with another body in space involved. So the only other possibility is that, you know, on all current models that are out there of the formation and composition of comets, that something had to have been used to blow it up. It was a little demonstration on the part of somebody to send a message to somebody else that they had a very, very sophisticated, very powerful, very capable technology.
Well, that's worrisome.
That's very worrisome.
All right, let's go to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. All right. 1-800-289-1092, and it's toll-free throughout North America. Please, when you call, be prepared to speak. 1-800-289-1092. Yeah, that is worrisome for a lot of reasons. It's not too worrisome to me if it's in our hands or very, very friendly hands. It is very worrisome to me if it's not in our hands at all.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. My guess and speculation would be that it's at least in our hands in the sense of somebody on planet Earth. But as to who it would be, there's only a very few nations in the world with the technological sophistication, I think, and the physics that it implies to have developed something like that.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Uh-huh. All right. Someone playing games. 1-800-289-1092 is the number to call. And Dr. Farrell, let me just say, we don't use, I tried for a while using a call screener. I don't use one because I like the spontaneity of me finding out who's there and what they have to say at the same time all the rest of the world finds out.
Same
so,
here.
Once in a while, we get someone who decides to be a jerk. Okay. 1-800-289-1092, and I pay for the call. Now, if it's in the hands of someone here on Earth, it still is really important that it be someone friendly.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it also says that if it is technology that did this, and if it is in the hands of someone on Earth, then we on Earth have the capability of perhaps protecting the planet from a planet killer.
Yes, yes. If you look at the literature that's out there and available concerning, you know, the so-called asteroid threat, you can go back to the middle, really, of the 1980s, and it really begins to kick into gear, high gear, in the early 1990s, of talking about space-based weapons to defend against asteroids. And the usual talk is some sort of directed energy weapon to do so. And in fact, the Russians are far more open in their discussions about using that type of weapon to do this than anybody else. Well, this implies, then, that we have a technology to do that sort of planet-busting thing already. And if that's the case, then you can only imagine what turning those weapons against the surface of the Earth would actually do.
Yeah, it gives you visions of the Death Star.
Yes, it does. It does.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Don calling from Phoenix.
Yes, Don.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Did you hear me talk about you earlier?
No, I got started in the show later. Did you mention
me? I did. I used your name in vain. I said about these lights over Phoenix that I have a very, very strong streak of let's wait and see-ism, like my good friend over at Alien Seeker News, Don Ellis.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Did you have a question or comment for the guest?
Yes, I did. John, a real quick question here. Have you ever gotten any confirmation? I realize there's probably there was no public, but any off-the-record confirmation from any of the former astronauts to back up to what you're saying?
You mean about there being things on the moon?
Yes.
Okay. Well, most of that research would be Mr. Hoagland's bailiwick, but I do know him personally, and we've corresponded at great length, and I can tell you that one of the very interesting things that he mentions in his book, Dark Mission, is that when queried about their experience on the moon, many of the astronauts seem to have some sort of memory lapse. They talk in generalities. They don't talk about anything specific. And it's his theory that as part of their debriefing process, they underwent some sort of selective memory alteration.
All right, we have to get to the rest of that after this break, Dr. Farrell. I apologize. Folks, more with Dr. Joseph Farrell right after this, and with your telephone calls and some flash messages, all right? 1-800-289-1092.
Two, three, four.
Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
We are back. My guest is Dr. Joseph Farrell. We had to cut you off, Dr. Farrell, because of the break. You know, it's automated. It takes over, and when it takes over, we have 30 seconds of music, and then our mics go dead. So that's the way that happens. So please continue.
Well, basically, I was simply answering the caller's question about the astronauts on the moon and Mr. Hoagland's hypothesis that because their memories seem to be so vague and general, that there is an indication, perhaps, that they have had some sort of selective memory wipe, certain things that have simply been taken out of their consciousness that provokes a kind of a response that you get from them. And I think that's very plausible, given the fact that the photographic evidence that he's uncovered is so very, very persuasive that they did indeed find evidence of a technology and civilization that had been there.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
My name is Ralph, and I'm calling from Alberta, Canada.
Ralph, are you a first-time caller?
No, I've phoned in a few times before.
All right. Go ahead with your question or comment.
I was just curious if, out of all the ancient text, if there was any physical description given of any of the players involved in this war.
Well, there is not, other than the references to these gods are accompanied very often in Sumerian and Babylonian and Assyrian friezes, and I reproduce one of them in the book itself of the god Ninurta. But one thing that is clear from the friezes is if one understands them to be literal interpretations, then these people were of very, very large stature. In other words, they were giants. And I find that very interesting because in Dr. Van Flandern's exploded planet hypothesis, the planet that explodes would have been of the approximate mass of Saturn. In other words, a very, very massive planet. But it would have been a solid planet. So if we assume that there was intelligent human-like life on it, then most likely, given the much higher gravity, they would have had much larger physiologies to make up for it, to be able to enable them to live in an environment like that. So it's an excellent question.
Okay, Ralph, does that answer your question?
Sure, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's take on some of these flash messages. This one from the UK. Very interesting show. Just wondering if the missing planet that was between Mars and Jupiter, which is now the asteroid belt, was destroyed during this galactic war, and is this why we have the asteroid belt where it is? If this was the case, there may well be artifacts among the asteroid belt. Of course, they won't tell us if there is.
Well, interesting question. I do believe that the asteroid belt is the result of this war. In other words, that the planet was blown up as an act in this war. And as far as artifacts on the asteroids, it's very interesting to me that NASA recently launched a probe to the asteroids to explore some of the larger ones. And in doing so, they admitted for the first time that they are using an alternative technology, because the rocket that is taking this probe to the asteroid belt is an ion propulsion rocket. Now, this is the first time NASA has admitted that they have such a technology, but the actual basis for the technology, when you research the literature, this goes back literally decades. In fact, it was first proposed, in fact, by the Nazi Germans. So, again, it's taken this long for NASA to get around that they're using more than just ordinary chemical rockets.
All right. Phil from Australia has written back in. He's the one that asked the question about Ron Hubbard's story. Uh-huh. And he says, please note, I am not a supporter of Scientology. Ron Hubbard, of course, is the founder of that.
Right.
But he says, Ron Hubbard was the father of Scientology. He claimed that there was a cosmic war and that an evil lord was banished to Earth.
Yes.
Okay, is the text that you have examined, do they talk about this?
Oh, yes, they do. As a matter of fact, I first mentioned this in one of my previous books called The Giza Death Star Destroyed. And the lord in question is the Babylonian god Nergal. Nergal is their god of Mars. And if you read the texts that I reproduce in The Cosmic War, he is the quintessential Babylonian version of Hitler. He is a warlord extraordinaire. He has absolutely no compunction whatsoever about any form of life and using it and slaughtering it in epic proportions. So, yes, the answer to that question is clear.
All right. From Rob in Australia, he says, is it true that if the wave function collapses, the electromagnetic field must give up its quanta? If so, then zero-point energy is a reality. Could this be what the war is over? Is it over zero-point energy?
Yes. Any time that you have a physics that is capable of manipulating the fabric of space-time, you have a weaponization potential that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So, again, we are dealing with a physics with potential for extraordinary good, but by the same token, we're dealing with a physics with extraordinary potential for evil.
Almost every form of energy that has ever been developed, I would, to the best of my knowledge, every form of energy that has ever been developed has been weaponized.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really, Kevin, kind of one of the motivations I write these books, because there is a certain segment of society out there that says that zero-point energy or vacuum flux manipulation or torsion manipulation of space-time, whatever version you want to consult, there is a school of thought that this is an extraordinarily good thing and will bring an era of unprecedented peace and plenty for humanity. Well, it's true, it would solve a great many of our energy problems, but by the same token, the downside is that the weaponization potential of that sort of physics is so very, very extreme.
And based on what you said about the comet Holmes, it would appear that it has been done.
Somebody has an extraordinary technology. Even if it's only a technology that employed, standard rockets, this would mean that they have a very sophisticated targeting technology, that they have, by the same token, a very sophisticated and advanced way of targeting things at that distance, and so on and so forth. So any way we slice this, we're dealing with something very extraordinary.
All right. We're racing toward the end of the show. We will continue to discuss right up till the end of the show, but I want, again, for you to tell folks how to get their hands on this book. I have found this book to be a mind blower. It's absolutely phenomenal. And I highly recommend that people get their hands on it and read it. And I think they will do what I've done. They'll read it more than once.
Well, it's available from Adventures Unlimited Press, and they can go online to www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. That's all one word, all lowercase. And if they want to call during normal business hours, that number is 1-800-718-4514. And there is a discount on three or more books of 10% from Adventures Unlimited.
All right. So, folks, I told you we were going to do that. I told you to get your pencil and paper ready, and I hope you did. AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, all right? Or Amazon, or Barnes & Noble. All right, now, I guess I've sort of saved this one for last on purpose. Is there anything in the texts that talks about these beings or their descendants coming back?
There isn't, as far as I've found. What is there is this very peculiar persistence of these beings for a very long time. And that would imply, then, the possibility that they're still out there, that they still have this technology and can still get here if they want to. And, you know, I have to hold open that possibility.
One of the things that's happening all around the world is people are seeing very, very large UFOs. The Stephenville UFO. Some of the reports make it a mile long, half a mile wide. That's big.
That's big.
Do you think there's any possibility, and it'll have to be a one-word answer because our theme music for the end of the show has started, any possibility that it's them?
Could be.
Could be. Okay. Two words. All right. Dr. Joseph Farrell. Folks, you got to go get this book. All right. Thank you for being with us. And it's been an absolute joy. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Absolutely.
And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. I'll be back tomorrow night. You be here too. Until then, so long, everybody.